Welcome to the fourth series of Inspiring West Virginians, profiles of people from the Mountain State who are leaders in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and business. I'm Jean Snediger. We hope the stories you'll hear will amaze and surprise you, and if you're a young person, that they'll encourage you to reach for the stars. First, someone that people all over the world know as the man with a beautiful mind.
This is my high school in Bluefield. It's a class reunion.
It's your 50th high school class reunion.
Yes. I'm in the corner here.
Yeah, how wonderful. The man in the corner is John Forbes Nash, Jr., one of the greatest mathematicians of the 20th century.
This is a picture of the high school building, Beaver High School. There's another high school now.
We're in his office on the ninth floor of Fine Hall, the math building at Princeton University, a place some people call the mathematical center of the universe. What is this?
An aerial picture of Bluefield. This is the nearby mountain. It's called East River Mountain. On the other side is Virginia. These clouds are pouring over from Virginia. But that is really to the east.
It almost looks like the sea pouring over into Bluefield, West Virginia, doesn't it?
And
one whole bookshelf in Nash's office is lined with photos of Bluefield, West Virginia. Now 84, John Nash left the state more than 60 years ago. But clearly, it's still important to him.
The Greater Bluefield Chamber of Commerce honors Dr. John F. Nash, Jr. for his contribution in the field of mathematics.
I just was visiting.
Over his lifetime, John Nash has sought out and solved some of mathematics' most difficult problems. And he solved them in ways that amazed other mathematicians, but not without great trials to overcome. In 2001, Ron Howard made a film about Nash called A Beautiful Mind, starring Russell Crowe. It won the Oscar for Best Picture and many other awards. The film and the book on which the film is based tell the story of Nash's meteoric rise in the mathematical world, his early career teaching at MIT, his sudden descent into severe mental illness, and ultimately his recovery from that illness. But John Nash's story begins in Bluefield, West Virginia, in Mercer County.
My mother had been born there, and she had sisters. Two of the sisters lived there and had children, and those were my cousins, and I was closer to them than other people. I had only one sibling, my sister. It was a special relationship.
I loved the mountains.
Martha Nash Legg remembers Bluefield as a nice place to grow up.
There was plenty of business going on. We had a wonderful neighborhood, children played. My parents had an active social life. We were reasonably well off, but not wealthy like some of our neighbors who were coal operators, who were extremely wealthy.
Tell me what John was like then.
Well, I guess today we'd call him nerdy. His friends were ones who also were bright. He liked science fiction. He was musical. Or he is musical to the extent that he can whistle Bach.
I was quite aware that I wasn't so close to other people that weren't related to me. I guess I'm a little like an Asperger's type.
So you found it difficult to make friends?
Well, not entirely difficult, but I didn't have very strong friendship relations. Generally, I wasn't just a buddy of the group.
Johnny Nash, as he was known then, came from an educated family. His father, John Nash Sr., moved to Bluefield from Texas to work as an electrical engineer for the Appalachian Electric Power Company. His mother taught high school English and Latin before she married. Even as a little boy, Johnny was drawn to mathematics.
I did have a taste for numbers. In school, I liked to work with larger numbers than we were taught to use. To numbers of five digits rather than two or three.
Even back in grammar school, when the teacher told my mother that he didn't understand the math, and of course my mother told her that she knew he did, and he just did it differently. But I knew he was plenty smart. I would have math workbooks that I let get behind me. I had pages to do. if I needed to get that finished up, I got John, and we got that finished up in a hurry.
You talk about a book that you read that really influenced you.
Men of Mathematics by E.T. Bell. He's an American. It's entirely about European mathematicians over a certain period of history. But the book was somehow inspiring, the way it talked about the mathematical discoveries and what these people had done.
Nash was particularly intrigued by the 17th century French mathematician Pierre de Fermat. As a young teenager, John succeeded in proving Fermat's theorem.
It developed from a coincidence. It's something called the binomial theorem. And a generalization of that is a multinomial theorem. It followed from that generalization.
And you figured it out.
Yes, the binomial theorem says you have a plus b raised to the nth power, that this is, it can be expanded in a certain form. Well, if you can have a plus b plus c raised to the nth power, then this expands in a certain form. Well, if n is a prime, then all of these terms are divisible by n, except for the a to the n plus b to the n plus c to the n. When you finally break a number down and A, B, C, D are 1, and then you get the number and everything else is divisible by the prime.
And that's how a 14-year-old proved Fermat's theorem. When he was still in high school, John helped his father solve a difficult problem at work. Together they developed a formula for calculating catenary curves, the sag between poles in electrical transmission lines. The formula is still used today across the United States and the world. Then John won a George Westinghouse scholarship to Carnegie Mellon University, then known as Carnegie Tech, in Pittsburgh. Originally, he planned to follow his father into engineering, but soon switched to mathematics. In 3 years, Nash earned both a bachelor's and master's degree in mathematics. People began to get an inkling of how brilliant this young man was.
I'm Steve Shreve. I'm the Orion Hoke Professor of Mathematical Sciences at Carnegie Mellon University. I grew up in Greenbrier County in West Virginia. When I came to Carnegie Mellon, which was 1980, there was Dick Duffin, who was John Nash's teacher when Nash was here in the late 40s. And Dick remembered him well. And one of Dick's favorite boasts was that he recognized that John Nash was a genius. He recognized it early. He encouraged him to go to Princeton for his PhD. And when Dick then was asked to write a letter of recommendation for John, Dick was fond of telling the story. He said it was the shortest letter he ever wrote. It was, "John Nash is a genius." And then he signed his name.
When he got to Princeton, Nash mixed with some of the world's leading mathematicians and scientists of the day, including Albert Einstein. Now, not many PhD students write a thesis that changes the world. But that's exactly what John Nash did. His dissertation was in a field called game theory, at the time a relatively new concept that explains human behavior. Nash's work in game theory was in non-cooperative games, where binding agreements aren't possible.
Suppose we had Target and Walmart, and they're thinking about pricing, say, a stroller.
Cliff Hawley, professor of economics at West Virginia University.
And they both choose low price. They have two choices, low price or high price. We would think about, say, Target choosing low price, and we would say, is this the best strategy for them, given that their competitor, Walmart, charges a low price? And it probably is, because if they went to a high price, Walmart would get all the market. Similarly, is this the best strategy for Walmart to have a low price? It probably is. If they went to high price, Target would get all the market.
This low price decision is an example of what later became known as the Nash equilibrium.
Because each player is doing the best he can given the behavior of the other rivals.
In the decades since Nash wrote his PhD thesis, The Nash equilibrium has been used in a wide variety of applications, from politics, foreign policy and diplomacy, to information technology, and even evolutionary biology. But while John Nash is most recognized today for his work in game theory, he also solved a few very, very difficult problems in pure mathematics. By doing so, he's inspired generations of young mathematicians, including Deon Slabchev, Associate Professor of Mathematics at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
One of the things that are really amazing about John Nash and that impressed people in my field, he would attack the most difficult questions in the field, spend a year working on them until he really cracked the problem. I mean, that's not really a sensible approach to a field, right? Usually you try to learn a lot, you try to talk with people, you make some small contribution, you understand something, then you contribute a little bit.
Not John Nash.
He was incredibly brave. He was audacious in trying the most difficult problems, working until he cracked them. So that's really absolutely amazing about him. And that's true not just for his contributions to differential equations, but also for the other work that he did.
Nash literally astounded the mathematical world with two short papers in differential geometry. But at the height of this brilliant mathematician's career, at age 30, John Nash developed paranoid schizophrenia, a severe mental illness. For more than 25 years, he had all kinds of delusions about who he was, who other people were, messages he was receiving. By this time, he had a wife and son. His wife divorced him, but later, when he had no other place to go, she took him into her home as a lodger. He wandered the campus of Princeton University, especially the library's under Fine Hall, the math building, whistling Bach to himself. People called him the Phantom of Fine Hall.
Go down to floor L, which is below the entrance level at this tower. Okay.
Professor Nash takes me down 10 flights to the Fine Hall Library underground. This library connects to a maze of underground libraries in the sciences.
Now we can walk to the left here.
Okay. We're still within Fine Hall, though, right?
Yes. Because it there will be in the original math physics library.
Did you used to study in here or research in here?
I used to spend a good bit of time in here.
Did you spend time here when you were ill?
Yes. I was a person out of ordinary communications, more or less, but I would write things on blackboards sometimes, at least at first.
You spent a long period of your life in what you call delusional thinking, or what's called schizophrenia or paranoid schizophrenia. And then without medication, you started to get better. Tell me how that came about.
The return to sanity was a gradual process, but like I rejected listening to voices internally, I got to thinking about the phenomenon of voices as something that was simply a symptom, and I began intellectually realizing that I was creating the voices in a corner of my mind. I was talking to myself, but I at first thought that something, a message is like a telegram, a telephone call, that it seemed as if persons were communicating with me. But then that didn't get confirmed that there was anyone in particular, so I was able to put it aside after a while.
One morning in 1994, a few years after John Nash returned to what he calls rational thinking, an amazing thing happened, as John's sister, Martha Nash Legg, remembers.
I had gotten up, and I was in the bathroom getting ready to go out with my dog, and the radio was on in the bedroom there. And I heard them say something about the Nobel Prize Award in economics. And I thought they said John Nash and game theory. I had no idea game theory had anything to do with economics. That's how much I knew about it. And brought tears to my eyes thinking how much my parents would have loved to have heard that.
After years of illness and unemployment, the Nobel Prize literally changed John Nash's life. Princeton University appointed him a senior research mathematician. Other awards and honors followed.
In 2001, Nash remarried his wife Alicia, 38 years after their divorce. The man who was almost forgotten was invited to lecture at universities throughout the world.
Perhaps today, the thing to be most proud of it is that he did turn back to rational thinking. And that's a rather amazing thing. And that gives hope. That gives a lot of hope to people and to families who have felt like things are pretty hopeless. I don't know that it will work for everybody, but it does give hope.
For other mathematicians, John Nash's work is like great music or poetry, created by a beautiful mind. Deon Slabchev.
We sometimes like to hear new music. We want to hear new ideas. We want to see some new themes, new songs that excite us and so on. So similarly in mathematics, you want to see new ideas. And everyone has the same tools, right? And now you see someone having a new idea, seeing things in a different way, introducing a new object that suddenly makes everything clear. Nash's papers, they are very brief and have many ideas in them. You know, it's not just one idea that solves everything, but at every step there is a new idea, and yet there is the whole picture of how everything fits together, right? So that is the beauty of the thing. So it's clear that he was very ambitious, right? That he, you know, didn't settle for just a little thing. If you speak about the beautiful mind, then it must be the mind which is able to store so many new ideas together at the same time, right? Must be in some way beautiful.
Now, most people, of course, are retired by your age, but you're still working.
It's true, yes. It's not unusual to work to 70, maybe 75, but now I'm 84. I could go to 90.
You're listening to inspiring West Virginians, men and women from the Mountain State who are leaders in the sciences and in business. Next, a woman from Harrison County who's making a difference every day.
Diane, we've just come down 79, and here we are at the...
It's called I-79 High Technology Corridor, and we work for the West Virginia High Technology Consortium Foundation, and we do the security, maintenance, and janitorial for all these facilities here. It's one of our commercial clients. My name is Diane Lewis. I am the President and CEO of Action Facilities Management. I grew up in Clarksburg, West Virginia, which is part of Harrison County. I went to Liberty High School, and then I went to Fairmont State College. I have an accounting degree, and I have a banking degree from Fairmont State College. And from there, I started working, and I haven't stopped.
The headquarters of Lewis's company, Action Facilities Management, or AFM, overlooks I-79 near Morgantown. AFM employs more than 300 people in 9 states. In addition to commercial contracts, they provide security, maintenance, and ground services for an impressive list of government agencies.
We work for Homeland Security,
the FBI.
We do work for the Department of Defense,
the General Services Administration,
Department of State,
FEMA,
CDC, which is Centers for Disease Control,
the U.S. Navy.
We have the National Energy Technology Laboratory, and we also do work for another Department of Energy called the Office of Legacy Management,
among others. In the 1990s, Diane worked for a company in Morgantown owned by a man called Kenny Jackson. In 2001, when Jackson was winding down his company, he encouraged Diane Lewis to start her own. She did, in her basement, with her teenage son as her only employee.
I told my son, I said, "You're going to have to be my secretary." And he's like, "I don't want to be a secretary." And I'm like, "Yes, you are." And so we started in slow beginnings. 2003, I started marketing to the federal government, and I actually received my certification through the U.S. Small Business Administration in Clarksburg, and I actually got our first contract in 2004.
Today, Lewis's son, Don Hill, manages the company's Washington, D.C. offices. Her daughter, Stephanie, works for the FBI. As a leader, 50-year-old Lewis aims to make sure her customers are happy.
There's Brad.
My name is Brad Calandrelli. I'm Director of Facilities at the High Tech Consortium in Fairmont, West Virginia. And I first met Diane about 5.5 or 6 years ago. She cares about her clients. She checks up on us to make sure we're happy, and if there's things that aren't working well, she makes sure they get corrected. But I also think she's a very good employer. the type of work that some of her employees do, the janitorial services, tend not to make a lot of money, but she makes sure that they have benefits, health care, vacation, 401k, and a lot of small companies cannot provide that to her, their employees, but she cares about her people and she cares about her customers.
As far as the training, the security training that they had this past weekend, can you tell me how that went?
It went well. Rick covered pretty much everything.
Dale Eagle supervises more than 20 of Diane Lewis's staff working here at the High Tech Foundation.
It's very seldom that you get to work in a company where a member of middle management can actually make a phone call to the CEO of the company and discuss business matters. It really is beneficial and helps members like myself and middle management to do our jobs when we're able to speak with Diane and other members and directors of AFM.
Incidentally, after Diane Lewis raised her son and daughter on her own, she married Kenny Jackson, the man who once encouraged her to start her own business. Today, he's a consultant for Diane's company. This successful businesswoman comes from humble, hardworking roots.
I was the youngest of seven children. We were very poor. I didn't even realize how poor we were at the time. In our house, we had three bedrooms and there was nine people in the house. So it was really crowded. I slept at the bottom of my parents' bed for the first 7 or 8 years that I can remember until one of my siblings moved out. And then I got to move up to another bed, you know, that I had to share. My dad's education, he actually went to first grade, skipped to third grade, and then he quit school when he was 8 years old.
Why did he quit school?
His family was so poor, but he was the oldest, and he actually went to work to try to help the other of his siblings. I mean, he was just a very hard worker. And my mom was born in Gilmer County. She was one of 16. And she actually went to the 11th grade. And that's at that time, from what I understand, that they moved to Clarksburg, and that's where she met my dad.
Okay, Diane, here we are in Clarksburg.
Yes, actually, we're on Route 50. And we're almost to the West Pike Street exit, and that's the exit to Adamston. Clarksburg was booming at the time. The glass factory, which was at the bottom of our hill, probably employed 200 to 300 people. You know, there was filling stations everywhere. There was bakeries. There was barber shops. There was just all kinds of business around that area. You really didn't even have to leave the Adamston area, as we called it, to go get anything. Everybody was always riding their bikes around, and there was a playground, and, you know, everybody looked out for you. When I was 8 years old, I worked at the Dairy King, and I didn't work for money. I actually worked for a hot dog and a Coke. My sister and I, Patty, we would actually go and pick up the paper and all the debris that people had left down there. And that's how I started, like 8 years old.
Right there.
Yes. It's just amazing to know that it's still there. And you'll see here, Adamston Elementary, and that's where I went to elementary school at. And this is where my dad's house used to be now. My dad worked at Union Carbide for like 33 years. He actually had a wooden leg, and he always worked the 3 to 11 shifts. So when I was coming out of school, he was always coming down the hill, and I'd just wave at him, and I'd say, I'd see you tonight when you get home. And he'd get home like between 11:30 and 12, and I could not go to sleep until I saw him at night. He always taught me never to be late. You always tell the truth, no matter what, good or bad, you tell them the truth, and that you have integrity about what you do.
When Diane started elementary school, she was just an average student.
My third grade teacher really changed my life. Her name was Mrs. Bonner. She just took me sort of under her wing. She started with my handwriting and told me I had very nice handwriting, and she, it's like she believed in me, and she told me, she says, Diane, you can do whatever you want to do. And I thought, really? And so after that, I mean, it just put me to where I tried a little harder. And next thing I knew, I was making A's. And you know, I just remember my brothers and sisters were doing mediocre. And from that point on, I decided, you know what, I'm going to give it my best. And so I give a lot of credit to her. My favorite subject was math. And I think the math is because I can remember when I was small that my parents would argue over the money. But it was a small house, so you could hear everything. And I just wanted to understand what the problem was with the money. I thought that if I understood the math, then I could understand the money. And I knew if I could understand the money, then maybe I could help them.
I'm Donna Jean Forge. I am Diane Lewis Jackson's sister. Growing up, she was Very smart, very smart. When she had to study for a test, she would study for hours, and I mean hours. She was going to be the achiever in the family, and she is. She has really achieved more than any of the rest of us had. My parents would be so proud of her. If they were alive to see what she's accomplished, they would be so proud of her.
When Diane was 15, she started working at McDonald's in Clarksburg and worked there all the way through high school and college. Though her parents didn't live to see her success as an entrepreneur, she's giving back to her community in other ways. Today, along with husband Kenny Jackson, Lewis runs a nonprofit organization called Members of Diversity, helping youngsters from minority groups to develop the skills they need to find jobs. She knows from experience the hurdles you have to overcome to make it in business or anything else.
I will never know to what degree those challenges are out there, but I know when I go on bids, and I've been on walkthroughs where I actually had a gentleman, a white gentleman, say to me, he said, "Well, take good notes for your boss. I'm sure he'll need them." He automatically assumed I could not own the company. And then after I won, he called me up and said, could he do anything to help me? And he didn't realize that I owned the company, and it was his mistake, and that he would never make that mistake again. But, you know, it happens. I don't know if it's a disadvantage sometimes or more of an advantage, because they underestimate me a lot of times.
Lewis is a director of a group called Teaming to Win, one of the largest and most successful events in West Virginia for small businesses. She also serves on the Board of Governors of West Virginia University.
Anybody, if you spent 10 minutes with her, you walk away going, oh my gosh, what a great woman, what a great person. And that's who she is.
James Clements, president of West Virginia University.
The first thing you notice about Diane, she's got an incredible smile. And what it shows is her warmth. And if you ever look into her eyes, you can just tell she's such a good person. She's wonderful on the board. She's an amazing leader, an entrepreneur. So many things about Diane jump out as special. One that shows how special she is, and I think her husband, Kenny, we have four children. Our youngest is Grace, who is the love of our life. Grace has multiple special needs, and she's just the sweetest girl in the world. She's 12. Grace just loves Diane and Kenny. She just loves them. So anytime they come to a football game, Grace wants to sit with them. Grace wants to be with them. You almost think they treat Grace like she's one of theirs. But again, it's her love for everyone and her kindness that becomes attractive to anybody who's near her.
Earlier this year, Diane Lewis was named the Small Business Person of the Year in West Virginia. Her employees and customers alike were delighted. Brad Calandrelli.
She could go elsewhere and make a living doing what she does, but she likes living here. She likes this area. West Virginians are a different group of people. They're proud to be from West Virginia. And people who leave can't wait to get back. We're fortunate enough that she decided to stay here.
Tell me what you enjoy most about running this company.
I enjoy watching the faces of my employees. When I go to a site and whenever they walk up to me and they thank me for having health insurance, they thank me because they're able to buy a new car, they thank me because they've been able to qualify for a home loan, or they're putting their children through college. And whenever I see the product and service and the customer's happy and the employee's happy, it's the best feeling in the world.
In life, we all have been given opportunities to make a difference in someone else's life. Many times I think we don't even realize the impact that we might have. Diane is one, I am sure, just as that third grade teacher positively changed her life, she's done it over and over and over and over again for many people.
Next on Inspiring West Virginians, a man from Berkeley County who is working hard to keep the wild in West Virginia.
We're standing on top of Cave Mountain at an elevation of 2,777 feet. Straight across from us is North Fork Mountain. And then behind it, you can see an even higher mountain, and that's the Allegheny Front.
And if you look below us, about 1,400, 1,500 feet below us, the south branch of the Potomac has cut a canyon.
The Smokehole Canyon in Pendleton County, West Virginia.
That's about 13, 14 miles long between Cave Mountain and North Fork Mountain. And as we look to the right, which is looking to the north, we can see the canyon going through its most rugged section. Right below us is...
I'm Rodney Barges. I grew up on a small farm near Hedgesville in Berkeley County in the eastern panhandle. It was a little farm of about 10 acres, and we had cattle and hogs and gardens and a lot of work.
You'll see a lot of cliffs. It's very jagged. It almost looks like the Rocky Mountains. Those cliffs are limestone. This is the biggest uplift of limestone in the eastern mountains of the United States. And a lot of the rare plants and animals in this canyon are associated with this limestone. Usually, limestone.
This 200-acre mountaintop property we're standing on has been owned by the Puffenberger family since 1965. But last year, they agreed to a conservation easement, which protects it from development. The agreement was negotiated by 54-year-old Rodney Barges, State Director of the Nature Conservancy of West Virginia. Barges, perhaps more than any other person alive, has helped to keep the wild in West Virginia.
There's the adult bald eagle. It looks like it's right over the river.
Oh, yeah, I see.
And you
yeah.
can see the white tail and yeah. all as it's moving. Look how that white tail just sticks out against the background.
He likes to call this particular property botanical heaven.
Along this crest is a series of old cedar trees that have been dated back 800 years and older. They are among the oldest trees in eastern North America. They're the oldest trees we know of in West Virginia. There's some other really interesting plants here.
Barges points out several plants found nowhere else in eastern North America. Prairie flax, the death camas lily, Indian grass, Sidoates grama, and big blue stem. Barges was the first person to identify these unusual species in West Virginia, among dozens of botanical discoveries he's made in the state since he was a boy in Berkeley County.
Growing up in the country, which was back then the country, but it's now pretty much suburbia, gave me a chance to not only explore the countryside, but to sort of tap into the knowledge of people that had grown up and had been there for decades longer, so I could learn from my dad and my uncles and my granddad. Some of my earliest memories are, as a little kid, riding on my dad's shoulders when he and his dad would be mushroom hunting.
Barges' family has been farming in Berkeley County for 10 generations. They always felt close to the land.
We like to hunt morels, mushrooms, in the spring of the year, and we did a lot of that. We like to hunt.
Rodney's father, Bob Barges.
When Rod, I think, was 10 years old, I took him back on the mountain. I told Rod, I said, Rod, right over top that knoll over there, there's a ledge that runs out to a certain next hollow. And when you get out there, there'll be a rock. I said, you be on that big rock when I get around there. So I made the loop around. And when I got there, he was sitting on the rock. That's the first time I had him out and could get him go out in by himself in a strange area, totally. And from that on, when I'd tell him to go someplace, he would be there. And he was real good at finding his way around through the woods.
My paternal grandfather, who never made it past eighth grade, while dirt poor, he made his living from trapping, a little bit of dirt farming, and from gathering herbs. And he could show me how in the woods or along the creeks or in the fields, certain plants grew in certain places. And if you were looking for a golden seal, you'd look in one type of woods. If you were looking for ginseng, in another, and so forth across the whole spectrum of plants that he would dig and sell.
Every day after school, once he'd finished his homework and chores, Barges spent an hour exploring the woods around his home. In the summertime, it was several hours.
When I was 16, I started to run into other young fellows that had similar interest. They were guys that hunted and fished, but also were into birds and plants and had a natural curiosity.
For more than 30 years, these four guys, Rodney Barges, Bob Dean, G.R. Welch, and Stan Corwin Roach, have been hunting rare plants together. hiking to some of West Virginia's most isolated, remote areas in the process. They took me on one of their favorite hikes to the Devil's Nose in the Sleepy Creek Wildlife Management Area, 23,000 acres that spans Berkeley and Morgan counties.
What are we about to go over?
This is the Meadow Branch that flows through the valley here. Mountain laurels that Rodney was talking about.
Rhododendron.
Predominant tree in here, the hemlocks.
We were up in here one day. Bob was along. And I was along. You were along?
It was icy that day.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could walk the creek on the ice. Okay.
Anyway, the tree was laying in the creek, and we sat on the tree and counted the rings, and we got up into the mid-400s. You know, that tree's probably 400, 500 years old.
Bob Dean on the path to the Devil's Nose. Rodney is such a unique amalgam of old-school woods learning, which was done in the woods, and highly educated besides, and has exercised opportunities to learn about obscure natural history elements like freshwater mussels and insects and ferns and all kinds of aspects of natural history, and is certainly one of the best ecologists and natural historians in the state, if not the very best.
While he was still in high school, before he went to Shepherd University to study biology, Barchus discovered the first white showy orchid in West Virginia.
That sort of got me thinking that, you know, there's probably neat things to be found in West Virginia then, that maybe not everything had been found. So as my buddies and I started exploring eastern West Virginia, we started finding that, hey, here's some plants that weren't known from this part of West Virginia, and we started stumbling across things that weren't known at all from West Virginia.
They found more than a dozen rare orchids, plus rare birds, salamanders, frogs, and turtles. But during this time, the Washington, D.C. suburbs were beginning to move more and more into the eastern panhandle.
And as a result, a lot of the places that I grew up hiking and botanizing and birdwatching on were being chopped up and turned into houses. And so I also got an interest in conservation.
Immediately after he finished his master's in plant ecology at West Virginia University, the Nature Conservancy hired Barchus to find unique and unusual places in the state that might be important to protect. They sent a biologist from Boston to help Barchus learn how to do the job. The two men decided to spend their first field day together in the New River Gorge.
And we're walking along this trail looking for certain rare plants. As we were walking back out, I noticed a clover along the edge of the path we were on, and I told the guy I was with, Cloyce. I said, Cloyce, that's running buffalo clover. And he said there was no way it could be, because at that point, running buffalo clover hadn't been collected in the wild for almost a half century, and had once apparently been very, very common along trails and paths and disturbances that buffalo had made. But as the buffalo disappeared and those disturbances disappeared, it had been declared extinct. So I said, I'm sure that's running buffalo clover. And he said, there's no way. He said, I'll bet you a steak dinner it's not running buffalo clover.
Rodney Barchus got his steak dinner. Those early years with the Nature Conservancy gave Barchus the opportunity to explore most of West Virginia on foot, looking for rare plants, special habitats, and unique natural areas.
You could blindfold Rodney Barchus and put him on any mountaintop in the state of West Virginia. And when you took off that blindfold, not only could Rodney identify every bird in the sky overhead and every single plant and tree that's growing on the ground, but he could tell you just by looking at his surroundings exactly where he's at.
Andrea Brandon, a colleague at the Nature Conservancy, echoes what a lot of people say about Rodney's encyclopedic knowledge of the natural world of West Virginia.
Most folks don't know that West Virginia is a national hotspot of biodiversity. So protecting this is incredibly important.
Elizabeth Byers, vegetation ecologist with the West Virginia Division of Natural Resources.
Among scientists, Rodney is universally respected. He is the person we go to when we have exhausted other resources because he will very likely know the answer. He's also a master of how human systems work, the politics, the economics, the infrastructure, how you work real estate and how you get legislation through. And he's made a really intensive study of this because he cares so much about protecting the wild things of the state.
Rodney Barges, along with his colleagues at the Nature Conservancy, has had a hand in conserving some of West Virginia's most unique wild places. In the New River Gorge, Canaan Valley, the Smokehole Canyon, Cheat Mountain, Cranberry Glades, Bear Rocks on Dolly Sods, Panther Knob, Pike Knob, and many, many more. He also discovered and has helped to conserve an important type of unique natural area.
If you look right through there, you'll see on that cliff there an open slope with some cedars. That is a cedar glade. It's a naturally open ecosystem.
Cedar glades are limestone sites in which the soils are too thin and too dry for forest to develop on. So they're almost prairie-like, with many rare plants or plants normally found west of the Mississippi River. In the 1980s, Barges discovered the first cedar glade in West Virginia near Petersburg. He tried to save it, but the site was quarried for limestone, so the rare plant habitat was destroyed.
That site had more rare plants and butterflies than any other spot in West Virginia, including Cranberry Glades. Matter of fact, to this day, if it still survived, it would have been the most unique natural area in West Virginia. So it increased my determination to do two things. One was to find more sites, which is why I started going to the remoter parts of the Smokehole nearby, and to do conservation to make sure that kind of thing would be less frequent in the future.
From the top of Cave Mountain, Rodney Barges points to a preserved cedar glade.
That's now the largest cedar glade area left in West Virginia. Unfortunately, it's on national forest. A large part of the remaining cedar glades in West Virginia are now conserved.
Barges and his colleagues work to preserve the natural areas for many uses: biology, ecology, hunting, fishing, hiking, and other recreational activities. And it takes the cooperation of landowners, donors, local, state, and federal government, and many, many others to make it happen.
Collectively, we're making progress. In the history of the Nature Conservancy in West Virginia so far, we've protected about 120,000 acres of West Virginia over the 50 years that the Nature Conservancy has been active in West Virginia. That sounds like a lot, but in every decade, there'll probably be 300,000 or more acres of West Virginia converted from natural habitat to something else. From a mall to a surface mine to a subdivision to a factory.
His legacy, it's going to be a vast amount of protected area in the state, are being so important nationally in terms of biodiversity with such a small conservation movement. He will be leaving behind hundreds of species, thousands of acres of just sheer beauty, mystery, awe, wonder, all of the things that our kids and grandkids won't see if they turn into shopping malls and subdivisions and they get mined over. He has an unbelievable legacy. Most of it will be unsung, but it's huge what he will leave.
In our final profile of inspiring West Virginians, we meet someone who, as a teenager, was a science geek. Today, she is known for her contributions to science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and business.
Jean, I'm going to take you into my biosafety level 2 laboratories in the Bio 5 building at the University of Arizona Medical School. We handle microbes that can make you sick, but generally not kill you.
But you also have a lab where you handle microbes that can kill you.
Yes, that's a BSL-3 laboratory, and that is highly regulated by the CDC. I'm Linda Powers. I grew up in Beckley, West Virginia, and I am currently the Thomas R. Brown Distinguished Professor of Bioengineering at the University of Arizona. I am also a professor of electrical and computer engineering and a professor of biomedical engineering. Okay, this is an instrument which I've built. I have a number of patents on these kinds of instruments. This instrument is particularly good for looking for microbes on surfaces.
This small handheld biosensor, one of several clever instruments that 63-year-old Linda Powers has designed, is small enough to take on a backpack out into the wilderness or the desert and can detect microbial contamination in real time.
Surfaces. Let me show it to you.
Cool. Okay.
Now, these are lights. You don't touch the sample, ever.
Right.
So this is good.
Yes. It's okay, just on top of a counter or something.
This is light. The light shines on the surface, like my hand here, and the light comes from these LEDs. And this is the detector, so the light captures the fluorescence. And you read it out here on this small computer. Or in when I was in the Arctic, we used a PDA, just a little handheld thing.
And then you can see what microbes are on that surface.
That's
almost
right.
Instantly?
Yes, instantly. Okay, because it's light. Okay, we're using light. We can't tell what species they are, but I can tell you there's microbes there and the microbial load. And the reason that's important is because these guys are communal, microbes are. And if you have large communities, you will have pathogens living in there. The instruments that I have been building for the last 15 years are aimed at looking for essentially life in extreme environments or life in places where it is very difficult to do the standard microbiological or biological testing. And so we have been building instruments that allow us to measure very, very small amounts of microbial contamination on surfaces, whether it's food preparation surfaces, the hospital operating theater, the hospital operating utensils, and air and water fluids. This one is specifically for looking at water quality.
Power's instrument to test water quality instantly using light can be used to monitor a city water supply or a well in an African village. She also designs and builds instruments for the Department of Defense and NASA. Much of that work is secret. But one of her instruments, for example, can detect possible bioterrorism. Another, life on Mars. Currently, she's working on a contract for the Department of Defense to develop a small, disposable blood testing kit.
That takes whole blood, a drop on a test kit that will tell you whether or not the blood is contaminated. So it could be used, for example, in the field for blood transfusion. And you can understand why this would be of interest to the Department of Defense.
Would one of these tests be like a cheap test to know if somebody in Africa had HIV?
Or? You bet. The other big use for this is for third world countries. These are disposables. These are things that can be done at point of care. So if you live out in a village where you have to hike miles to, as I have done, you can use those there. You don't have to make the individual come into a hospital to have these kinds of tests. You can have the answer right there, and they can be treated right there.
Since middle school, Powers has been interested in light, or fluorescence. She was a pioneer in the use of something called synchrotron radiation, as well as X-ray absorption spectroscopy. Today, she co-owns a Tucson-based company, Microbiosystems, which develops fluorescence instruments for biomedical applications.
So in the nanoparticles project,
yes.
She's had her fluorescence instruments around the world, quite literally. She's taking them by backpack into high deserts in Chile. She's taken them to the Arctic Circle, to East Africa, and so on.
One of Power's colleagues, biomedical engineer Walter Ellis.
There isn't any company, any other group, that is doing the kinds of things that she's doing because it's very hard. You have to combine a variety of areas of expertise from electrical engineering and optics to microbiology and some knowledge of how cells work, so biochemistry and so on. And it takes someone with a willingness to look at things from many different points of view. And most people don't do that. They stay in their own little niche and try to find applications for that instead of try to find important problems and then ask, okay, what should we do about this?
This is the electrical and computer engineering building, and we're going down to my instrument development laboratories to see a 200 megahertz fluorescence instrument.
Wow. Okay.
With the help of one of her PhD students, Jerry Fairbanks, Linda Powers is building a tiny prototype instrument. So far, it doesn't have a name, that can take data from anything that fluoresces. That is, something that emits light or other radiation. And it can do it in as little as a few billionths of a second.
Okay. What is your estimate that we're running at right now with all the improvements you've made?
Okay. So the fastest that we can turn off a diode right now is about 6 nanoseconds. So what we're trying to do is measure the fluorescence decay of biomolecules. And the decay is indicative of what kind of chemicals are in cells and different things and the concentrations. So I've got the LED flashing right now. The light is turning off in about 8 nanoseconds right now.
When they get the light turning off in 1 nanosecond, 1 billionth of a second, this instrument may be able to measure biomolecules in cancer instantly without having to culture cells. It could also collect data from space.
If you were flying this, for example, on one of the spacecraft, you could be taking data from something that's down on the ground because you're taking data fast enough to be able to look at different points as the thing is flying. There is not currently an instrument that is capable of taking this data that fast.
So what I've just seen is the future.
Yes, it's one of a kind at the moment.
Most people agree Linda Powers herself is a one-of-a-kind. Not only is she a leader in her field, which incorporates science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, she has an adventuresome spirit. She's an accomplished horsewoman who competes at the international level. She snowboards in Utah, windsurfs in the Caribbean, abseils down wet, vertical canyons on a rope, and drives around Tucson in an open-top Jeep. But most of her childhood was spent in a little white house on a modest street in Beckley, West Virginia.
Beckley was a very small town when I was growing up. I knew most of my graduating class. I lived there from the time I was 3 until I left for college at Virginia Tech when I was 17. I have one sister who's 7 years younger than I am, and she is a nurse practitioner. My father worked for Eastern Associated Coal Corp, and my mother was a stay-at-home mother, and my mother was wonderful.
When did you first realize that you were interested in science? Take me back to that day.
That was third grade, and I wanted a telescope for Christmas, and I got a telescope for Christmas, and I was hooked.
Where did that come from? Where did that interest come from?
I have no idea. But it was there, and it was a very strong force in my life.
When she was in the 8th grade at Beckley Junior High, she won first place at the West Virginia State Science Fair for a project using light. It was one of many science fair awards.
My mom in particular didn't understand half of the things that got me excited, but she would sit by the hour and listen to me rant and rave about it.
So you were what we would now call a science geek?
Oh, yes. Very much.
Here she is, right here. There's Linda.
Oh,
is she darling?
Yeah.
This is Linda.
Kathy Smith Simmons, classmate of Linda Powers at Beckley's Woodrow Wilson High School.
Okay, Kathy, we're behind the old high school.
Mm-hmm. I remember Linda walking to and from class with her. She was just always so friendly and nice and happy. And I don't think I ever remember seeing her down. She was just really positive about her life, and I really feel like Linda knew where she was going.
I came home one day from high school, and I says, I want to go to college. And, you know, my father's eyes got huge, but nobody said no.
Up to then, no one in the Powers family had gone to college. To see if she was really interested, her parents suggested she take some courses at Marshall University the summer before her senior year of high school.
I took courses in chemistry, and I did some experiments that turned out far beyond what anybody could have anticipated, and I wrote it all up, and that was what I wrote to the Westinghouse Science Talent Search, which I won in my senior year in high school.
Linda Powers was among the top 5 science students in the nation. It won her a major academic scholarship.
Here you are. You're on the cover of the Sunday Gazette Mail on April 3rd, 1966.
Right.
And they call you a test tube teen queen.
I know. Yes, that's me.
Powers went to Virginia Tech and earned degrees in chemistry and physics. Plus, she was just one course short of another degree in mathematics. She got a PhD in biophysics from Harvard University. From there, she was recruited to lead her own research group at AT&T Bell Laboratories in New Jersey, at the time, the finest research laboratory in the world. All through high school, college, and at Bell Labs, Linda Powers had a series of teachers and mentors who encouraged her to reach for the sky.
I have been fortunate in having a series of exceptional people mentor me. I like young people, and I love it when they're curious. Okay, I was like that. I see myself doing exactly that, and I say, geez, I know what to do because somebody else knew what to do with me.
There are a lot of people who, in capacities as mentors, think that the thing to do is to replicate themselves, to teach their students just one thing, whatever it is they do. And Linda's philosophy is no, do what you find interesting and be good at it.
Mentoring is a very, very important part of what I do. And I take particular interest in minorities and women and anybody else that I think may have not had a square chance. Mentoring is one of the most important things anyone can do.
One of the women Powers inspired is research scientist and engineer Lois Wardell.
She's really inspired not only women, but I think she inspires a lot of people. She really helps them develop their ideas and passion. She's been a real trailblazer, opening doors, helping encourage people, helping them find opportunity, and giving them opportunities.
I think that she carries a little bit of the spirit of West Virginia in her. She has a lot of grit. She's not the kind of person that will take no for an answer. And if something is hard, she'll likely dig her feet in and redouble her efforts and say, we're going to do it anyway.
What would you tell, if you could, youngsters growing up in West Virginia today? Perhaps math or science geeks like you once were?
The sky's the limit. And in West Virginia, that sky's even closer. There's no reason for you to have any problem doing what you want to do. If you want it, do it. Somebody will take notice along the way and help you. They certainly did me, and this was back when girls didn't do things like that. Don't let anybody stand in your way. Decide what you want and simply go for it. You'll be surprised at the people you'll find who will support you, especially in West Virginia.
You've been listening to Season 4 of Inspiring West Virginians, people from the Mountain State who are leaders in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and business. Inspiring West Virginians was produced and presented by Gene Snediger. The senior producer for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is Suzanne Higgins. The theme music is by Roma Yagnik. Music from the film A Beautiful Mind was composed by James Horner. Other music by Johann Sebastian Bach, Steve Luck, and Ed Bowes. Scott Prouty and John Gallagher played the traditional West Virginia tune, Big Hoedown. Special thanks go to Princeton University, Carnegie Mellon University, West Virginia University, and the University of Arizona in Tucson. To Action Facilities Management in Morgantown, West Virginia, to the Nature Conservancy in West Virginia, and to Davis and Elkins College in Elkins, West Virginia. Inspiring West Virginians is made possible by the ongoing generous support of the Miles Family Foundation, inspiring West Virginians to soar.